weekly, Friday,
Saturday. Ladies and gentlemen, you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars. And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. Glad to provide a little honestly provocative talk radio. And I thought I'd start with a comparison that you might find really, really strange. There are times where people get so tied up in dealing with the immediate problem in front of them that they forget there is a much bigger problem building that is just going to take them apart. And let me give you this illustration, because I still remember this. It was a little over 40 years ago. There was a DC-8 that was trying to land in Portland, and they were having problems with their landing gear. And it's a true story. And at some point, they realized, we either have to ditch this plane in the Columbia River, or we have to ditch on land. Well, thankfully, the pilot decided to ditch on land. But the part of the story most people don't realize is that in those days, they'd have a pilot and a co-pilot. This is on a DC-8. And there was actually a surprisingly small number of casualties. Most of the people on the plane survived. But there was also a flight engineer. And the flight engineer's job was to watch all the dials and the gauges and everything else and then call out numbers. So he'd be telling you, Captain, you've got 5,000 pounds of fuel left. You've got 4,000 pounds of fuel left. You've got 3,000 pounds of fuel left. Do you know the captain? The pilot and his co-pilot were so consumed with figuring out this landing gear problem that they didn't realize one of the people in the cockpit was telling them they were about to run dry on fuel, which is exactly what they did. They were so focused on getting those landing gear down, and they thought that was their biggest problem, that they ran out of gas. And in the end, they had to ditch the plane on the east side of Portland. As I said, it went down, and it was just pure, well, I guess, God watching out for fools, because when that plane came down, a small number of people, I believe it was 11 people, died. Everybody else in the crash survived, including, I think, the pilot. So, pilot, co-pilot. So, in any case, I was reminded of that when I consider what is going on right now. I mean, throughout the Northwest, you would think that illegal aliens are the biggest problem that is being confronted by the officials in Oregon and Washington. You would think that homelessness is the biggest problem that is being confronted by people in Oregon and Washington, Portland and Seattle, and all the other cities of the Northwest. And yet, while they're doing all that, focused on these issues that involve relatively small numbers of people, they are significant issues and significant amounts of money being spent on them. While they're doing all that, do you know what's happening? The leadership of the Pacific Northwest is allowing the Northwest to run out of gas, metaphorically, in the same way that that DC-8 ran out of gas and they had to make an emergency decision. Do we ditch in the Columbia River in the middle of winter, or do we put this down in a neighborhood? And so the pilot put that plane down on the darkest spot he could see. And it turned out there was only one house that was hit. And it was hit with one of the wings of the plane, and nobody was home and nobody got hurt. So it turned out to work out very, very well. God was watching out for fools. But I'm reminded of that because right now the Pacific Northwest is being given warnings. We've warned you on this show for the last close to 10 years that the Northwest is headed for disaster when it comes to electric energy. Now, if you say, Lars, you've got a dog in the fight because talk radio does not happen without electricity. No, I'd have to go door to door and do talk radio for a living when the electricity runs out. We are looking at blackouts in the Pacific Northwest coming up as soon as next year, maybe even this winter. And how did we get here? We got here because of deliberate decisions on the parts of the so-called leadership of Oregon and Washington. Decisions like Oregon closing its only coal-fired electric plant. Oregon demolishing a fully functioning hydro dam. And there are proposals to knock out the hydro dams on the Snake River that produce about 8% of all the power for Washington State. So this is a problem that extends to both of the states. And then you have politicians who paid tech companies, as pointed out by the Taxpayers Association of Oregon, to move here and use gigantic quantities of electric energy. In other words, set up your data center. We know it's not going to produce much in the way of jobs, because once it's built, 30, 40 technicians inside, 50 security people outside, and then they chew up a gigantic amount of electricity. Oh, and then, of course, you've got politicians in both Oregon and Washington that have bribed citizens, saying, if you'll just buy one of those electric cars that don't make financial sense, we'll pay you thousands of dollars. And the federal government will pay you thousands of dollars, too. And for a while, we'll do what the heroin dealer does. We'll give you a freebie. We'll give you free recharging. Believe me, that wasn't going to last very long. And then Joe Biden had to shovel in about $6 trillion in other spending. Part of it was the Inflation Reduction Act, which didn't reduce inflation, but it massively jacked up inflation. But it also spent a lot of the money on green energy, except green energy is not fitting the bill. I mean, right now, the wind and the solar panels of the Pacific Northwest are not going to replace Centralia 1, the coal plant that was shut down in Washington. They are not going to replace, when coal-fired electricity becomes illegal in the state of Washington, and it is next year, it's not going to replace the electricity they've been buying from other parts of the Pacific Northwest region outside of Oregon and Washington. So they're going to deliberately run us out of electricity. And right now, the upgrades to the electrical grid have shown that the states may see rolling blackouts during extreme weather as soon as next year. This is not a in-a-decade problem. This is a coming right up at you, getting in your face kind of problem, because we're going to run out of electricity. And, you know, I've wished out loud that if we could take the people who actually voted for these politicians, the ones who believe in all this green energy nonsense, your average Tesla driver, the person who tells you someday soon we will run out of, we won't be using oil anymore. You know, remember when Joe Biden about 4 years ago gave a State of the Union address and he announced to laughter that we were not going to even need the oil industry in a decade. He actually said that, and it was so ridiculous that while most people are on their best behavior when a president is giving a speech like that, the Republicans laughed out loud. And I'm sure the Democrats cringed because they realized that Biden was completely off his nut. Now, of course, that became more apparent later on in his presidency as President Otto Penn was completely failing to the point where his own party kicked him to the curb. But right now, we've got an energy situation in which they're going to start cutting off and doing rolling blackouts as soon as next year. Now, the only way there would be any kind of justice to this situation is if the Bonneville Power Administration and all the folks who actually distribute all that electricity to the Pacific Northwest, if they said, where were the strongest votes for green energy? Oh, downtown Portland, downtown Seattle, out in Bellevue. Those people seem to love green energy. How about Eugene? They love green energy too. Let's put them at the front of the line when it comes to the rolling blackouts. And when their heat goes out in the winter or their air conditioning goes out in the summertime, maybe they'll understand your decisions have consequences and there's no quick way to fix it. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to have you on the Radio Northwest Network. Your calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk. But fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
In Oregon or Washington, you need a stack of DUI convictions to get felony treatment, jail, or to lose your license permanently. That must change, or we're going to continue to hear deadly stories like this one. Rose Hitzfield had a DUI diversion in 98, a conviction in 08, and another conviction 2 years later in 2010. So let me put that in context. The average drunk driver does it 80 times on average before that first arrest. So statistics suggest that Rose Hitzfield likely drove drunk hundreds of times in the past almost three decades. The legal system could see evidence that she had a major problem and the law didn't stop her. Then she killed 82-year-old Marsha Abate about a year ago while drunk driving yet again. She has now pleaded guilty to the crime and she's headed to prison for 7 years. Now, I've got a bias on this, as you might point out. More than half a century ago, on New Year's Eve, ironically enough, my non-drinking mom died right in front of me in a car wreck where Klamath Falls cops told me the other driver was intoxicated. Rose Hitzfield had a blood alcohol of 0.18 in that accident that killed Marsha Abate, which for the average-sized American woman means six drinks downed in 1 hour. Oregon, Washington, for bizarre reasons I don't understand, gives drunk drivers too many second chances. And for the rest of us, that is sometimes deadly. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Our poll on X today. Should the U.S. only accept legal immigrants who will not cost taxpayers a dime in health care? That's actually written into federal law. Now, the State Department has sent out a cable to its consular officers around the world telling them to weed out applicants who want to enter the U.S. based on their age or the likelihood that they would need to rely on public benefits. Now, I know people are going to be outraged. They'll say, how dare Donald Trump do something like that? Well, the fact is, that is already written into federal law. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. CR writes in, Lars, this is or why is the government shutdown really ending? He says, if you want the truth about the shutdown and why it's ending, remember a few years ago when Pelosi, Obama, and their gang promised an average $2,500 a year in savings via Obamacare, and you could keep your doctor and keep your health plan. The truth is premiums soared up 250% and more for most of the Obamacare suckers. They're able to soar again for 2026. Additionally, a lot of people lost their previous plans and the doctors they're seeing. So much for big government health insurance. The whole purpose of Obamacare in the first place was to drive people into a single-payer government health insurance like the failed plans in the UK and Canada. As President Reagan famously said, the scariest 10 words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. Now, my favorite post on X today, Katie Daviscourt, posted this. Just in, the Border Patrol has released a video announcing the arrest of an illegal alien who was recently seen outside the Portland ICE facilities sitting on top of a horse. Jose Cayetano of Mexico had mocked ICE agents in the video, saying, don't try to stop me because I'm not going to leave. Border Patrol agents conducted an operation using air systems and arrested Cayetano. He is now in ICE custody pending removal from the United States. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Well, I know I've awarded the Daily Grill to the flawed vote-by-mail system in both Oregon and Washington before, but I'm going to do it again today, and in particular about the mayor's race in the city of Seattle. The race was held, and the vote was held a week ago Tuesday. So more than a week ago, you had all the ballots in, and yet there still is not a firm answer as to who is going to be the mayor of Seattle. And in that case, you had the choice of, Katie Wilson and then Bruce Harrell. And Bruce Harrell is bad, but she's worse. Well, they now have about 4,000 ballots that are facing what they call signature changes, either due to unsigned envelopes or mismatched signatures. And then voters are encouraged to track their ballots and make sure they're counted. Now it's not going to come down to who wants who for mayor of Seattle. It's going to come down to which side can actually cure more ballots or fix more ballots, as I might want to put it, since I think most of the vote-by-mail elections are fixed. Imagine that in a poll vote where people show up in person, they show ID, they're checked off in a book. You don't have a problem with signature challenges. You don't have to cure any ballots. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I've seen it with my own eyes because I hired them to do it for me. It's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or call 855-CAP. That Matt writes in, Lars, the Democrats in Congress aren't really jockeying for $1.5 trillion. They knew from the start the Republicans were not going to nuke the big, beautiful bill by giving them $1.5 trillion. That's the best indication that breaking the filibuster is all they wanted. Harry Reid broke the filibuster when it came to appointing federal judges. Senator Grassley told him if he does, he'll regret it. Sure enough, breaking the filibuster allowed Trump to get 3 Supreme Court justices. Imagine what the Marxists could do if they get the power, if Republicans nuke the filibuster. It can't happen. Well, Matt, I've got to disagree with you. I think we should get rid of the filibuster right away. I think that would make it real representative government. But anytime you can have 55 senators voting for something and say, no, it can't pass, you've got a majority of the representatives of the people saying something should pass, and you say, no, the Senate made its own rule called the filibuster. No way, no how. Let's go to Kyle. Hey, Kyle, welcome to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yeah, man, I was just thinking it's kind of funny that Trump's blasting Democrats for using shutdowns to get what they want, because he's the guy who presided over 3 government shutdowns, including the longest in U.S. history, all because Congress wouldn't fund his border wall.
Kyle, 3 of them? How about one?
3
of them. The one that was the record length one, 35 days. But he was trying to get something to benefit the American public because he had promised voters that he would seek to build a wall between Mexico and the United States. And voters said, we like that. And then when he ran the second time and promised the biggest deportation in history, Americans liked that. And according to the polls, they still do. What's wrong with seeking that?
I mean, you know, he turned shutdowns into a political stunt, holding federal workers' salaries hostage.
He invented shutdowns? It seems to me there have been about 20 government shutdowns, and yet you're giving Trump credit for inventing the shutdown?
Well, he acts like the Democrats invented it, but it's classic Trump. Start the fire.
No, the Democrats didn't invent the shutdown, but did they do this one? Were they the ones who refused to vote yes and then finally agreed to vote yes this week? They caused it and they cured it. The Democrats started the shutdown and they finished the shutdown. How could you say otherwise?
No, yeah, you're right. You're right there. I'll give you that. But at the same time, he's like
Lars Larson Show. Portland. What does Lars think about smoking the devil's lettuce?
I won't go schizo, will I?
It's a distinct possibility.
Now it's time to take a hit of Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for almost 30 years now. Great to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you get to go first. Consider this. A Portland City Council leader allegedly pushed to change a school policy right when her kid needed it most. Now, is that coincidence or corruption? I thought we'd talk to Aaron Mesh about it, managing editor at Willamette Week, founded WWeek.com. Aaron, welcome back.
Good to be here, Lars.
So are we seeing people in the new expanded, not much better, bigger but not better, city council of 12 pulling some real shenanigans, and one of them involves Elena Pirtle-Ginney?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those stories where at the end of the day, we'll probably never know. And that's because it's very much a she said story. The vice chair of the school board says that the president of the city council came to her and said, I'd like to change a policy that prohibits my kid from entering kindergarten the year that that I want the child to enter kindergarten. It's an odd little policy that affects only a few families, but it's like one of those classic cases that I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, where the cutoff date is September 1st, but if you were born on September 3rd, you don't qualify. One of those classic things, you know, like that competitive parents who want to get their kid moving faster in the school system want changed. The underlying policy, quite frankly, isn't the most interesting policy I've ever heard in my life, unless you happen to have a kid that was born between September 1st and September 10. But the question of whether or not a city councilor was, in fact, wielding her power, trying to change policy to benefit her family, is of some interest.
Well, I mean, is there any doubt that that's exactly what she was doing? Or does City Council President Ilana Pertl-Ginny say, no, I wasn't trying to, does she deny that she asked for the change?
She denies that she asked for the change in order to benefit her family. She says that she was asking for the change on behalf of other constituents. Yes, I also find this a difficult explanation to swallow, yes.
Now, hold on. So a member of the city council who has her own fish to fry is out asking for an obscure change to an obscure rule that just happens to affect her child, but she's asking everybody to believe that that it wasn't done to benefit her child, but she was just generally interested in admittance dates and deadlines for kindergarten?
Lars, I don't know what to tell you, except that is exactly the explanation that I have received.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. And do any of these people understand just how self-serving they all appear to be? It's like, you got elected to the city council. Are you going to go out and address the biggest problems that are affecting people in the city that you promised to represent? No, I'm going to go out on my own little political agenda. And in this case, this is just, you know, I guess I could call it unseemly. I think it's just wrong to get into a city council position and then say, I'm going to do things that benefit my family, and then ask everybody to believe that it just is coincidental that I have a child who happens to be affected by the policy.
I want to go back to something you said at the beginning of that monologue that I think is like the most important part of all this, is the sense that I have, that I think many Portlanders share. And this is a little bit of commentary from me, but, you know, we'll allow it.
Hey, we like commentary on this show.
But I don't think that most Portlanders would describe this city as being the most functional city in the United States. That they would not perhaps feel that, like, the core city services are being conducted in a way that benefits the most people. That that the trash on the sidewalks and the decaying assets in the parks and a slow response to 911 calls, these are all things that I think that people in this city care about and would like to see change. They may not agree on how they should be changed, but they certainly feel that, like, something is rotten in the state of Portland. And the fact that the people who are we've elected to this extremely large, greatly expanded governmental structure are not spending their time on this, but instead are spending their time on jockeying for power and telling us that their houses were burned down over political assassination attempts and seeking to benefit their own families potentially with small piddling policy changes. At a certain point, you do wonder whether or not we would just be better off if we found, like, I don't know, 12 dogs or cats from the local humane society and saw how they would do it running a government.
Yeah, because in a lot of ways it mirrors what's going on at Multnomah County and probably other parts of the Northwest. Because you had people in Seattle who were siphoning off homeless money to go to their own privately run NGOs, and you wonder what's the agenda there. Is it to solve the problem or to provide money there? Or Multnomah County, and that was Seattle, but in Multnomah County's case, it occurs to me the woman who was put in charge of the so-called early learning program, which is basically just glorified and very expensive daycare, and she manages to send $900,000, I think that was the number, to a company that she owns and is run by her family that's supposed to serve 69 kids, and they end up providing care for like 10 kids, so it works out to $90,000 a year to put one of those nine kids in early learning. And you say, no, she wasn't padding her own pocket. That was just, I mean, this stuff goes on all the time.
That one actually was really, unlike the story we're discussing today, there wasn't actually a lot of plausible deniability on that one. That one was just she's gone. At any rate, like we are in agreement here.
But she's not prosecuted, is she? I mean, she may be gone from her job.
Political views, but I think we share a desire to see the city do better by the people who live in it. And sometimes, frankly, I wonder whether or not that was the rationale that got a lot of the people who are currently in office to seek office.
Well, they did get about 25% of the voters each, didn't they?
Sometimes less.
Sometimes less. And by the way, you mentioned garbage. And I, you know, this is the one where I can't believe it, because I agree with you. Just keep the streets clean. And they're spending $1 million a month to clean up all the garbage and waste, and some of it very toxic stuff from the homeless. And the city council literally says, where can we find another $4 million? Oh, I know. Why don't we leave 4 million pounds of hazardous waste on the streets of Portland so we can save, meaning divert, the $4 million that it was going to cost to clean it up. Just leave the garbage there. We've got something better to spend it on. The fact that they can actually propose that with a straight face is crazy.
Lars, I had to be actually really careful on that story, and here's why.
Do you have a garbage company?
Because I walk to my car to do this call with you on my way to work, and I'm looking at the conditions of the streets on in Northwest Portland in the Knob Hill district, or whatever they call this.
Fancy.
Come on down here and check it out. You'll just see how fancy it is.
Oh, I've been there.
Once you get down off the hill in the Alphabet district, it's not so fancy no more. Anyway, you look at the conditions around, say, the McDonald's on West Burnside, which is what I'm talking about here, and then you hear the city council talking about, like, let's spend less money on cleaning up trash and enforcing camping laws, and then that's where I think I'm going to let my voice trail off and not
I think you should, because you'll get yourself in trouble. But Aaron, you're absolutely on the right track. They have an $8 billion city budget overall, and they don't manage to get the most important things done. But boy, when it comes to changing the admission dates for kindergartners, boy, the Pirtle Guineas of the world, they're out to serve themselves first. They get line first because they've got the title. That's Aaron Mesh, managing editor at WWeek.com, and you've got the Lars Larson Show.
Facebook, X, and Google may censor you, but you'll never find censorship here.
Don't censor me!
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. You know who has a lot of gall, or chutzpah, if you will, but really more gall? Governor Tina Kotek. She just finished posting about 20 minutes ago. She said, I am disgusted that President Trump has the audacity to take taxpayer money away from them when they are in crisis. Now, she's talking about SNAP, so it's a bit dated given that the government is cranking back up again. But she said, this is ridiculous, immoral, and Oregon will fight this every step of the way. It's kind of something for Tina Kotek to talk about things that are immoral You mean like taking stolen FTX money from investors who didn't know they were funding your campaign, and you take $500,000 and the donation itself is done illegally to the Democrat Party of Oregon, and then your friendly Dan Rayfield, the attorney general, says, no, I don't need to charge anybody with a crime just because they broke the law. And yet she's disgusted that Trump took the money away. In a government shutdown caused by Democrats and finally ended by 8 of the Democrats doing the right thing, while 40 of the Democrats voted no to restart the government. And yet Tina Kotek says it's Donald Trump who took the money away. Let's try a couple of facts there, Tina. The USDA at the time of the government shutdown had $6 billion in its emergency fund for SNAP. I do not consider a Democrat-caused shutdown of the government to be an emergency, but even if you did, the cost of 1 month of food stamp benefits, SNAP benefits, is $9 billion. The shutdown, by the time it ends, will have gone 1.5 months. So there you're talking about funding SNAP for those 1.5 months costs $12 billion. How much money did USDA have in the emergency fund? $6 billion. You'd think that even somebody as dim as Tina Kotek could do the math on that one. And the fact that Donald Trump runs the executive branch, he finally admits he's the guy in charge. Well, should the president have called up the head of USDA and said, go ahead, empty the emergency cupboard of every single dime in there and fund about 3 weeks of SNAP benefits? Well, that would have run out before Halloween, believe it or not. And yet Tina Kotek says this is Donald Trump acting immorally. No, you know what's immoral? What's immoral is when the Democrats decide we are going to commit extortion. We're going to shut down the federal government. We're going to hurt air traffic, SNAP benefits, all the other things that are dependent on the federal government. And we're going to do this because we are going to demand $1.4 trillion in additional spending. And you know what they got? They got bupkis. They got nothing. And they deserved nothing because they wanted to put a gun to the heads of Americans and say, we will shut your federal government down until you agree to give us more money. And, you know, God bless Donald Trump and especially Mike Johnson and, of course, Leader Thune in the Senate for saying, no, we're not going to cave in. You've got a clean CR. We can fund the government. You want all that extra spending? Let's have a separate vote on that. And I think the Democrats, even though they're going to get the separate vote, they understand they're going to lose that vote. In any case, glad to have you with me on a Wednesday, and always glad to take your calls. Let me update a couple of things, and I'll get to calls. This segment of the program is brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. And our poll on X, should the U.S. only accept legal immigrants who are not likely to cost the taxpayers a dime in health care? That's actually federal law, but now the Trump administration is telling the State Department when people come in and they want to apply to come to the United States on a green card, make sure that based on age and their training and skills, that they're not likely to end up dependent on public benefits. That's written into the law. That's not just a Donald Trump policy. That is in federal law passed by Congresses long before Donald Trump ever got to the White House. The Poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to George, who's a naysayer. Hey, George, thanks for listening on Corvallis on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Everyone's talking about Epstein. Are you still running cover for that pedophile in the
Do you White want to House? Talk about the Epstein emails? Let's do it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Let's start with the biggest one, where Epstein said in an email that he released as part of his sentencing process after he was found guilty. He said that Trump knew about the girls. What should we read into that sentence?
I would read it as Trump was sleeping with 15-year-olds.
Right from that. It's not possible that Donald Trump had actually said about Jeffrey Epstein that he tended to prefer younger women. And everything Trump has said. Second issue, in one of the emails, it says Trump talked to, and then they took the victim's name out, talked to her for hours at my house. Do you know who that person is?
Did ship is sinking. Do you plan to go down
with it? No, hold on, hold on. You don't get to answer my questions with more questions. I said I would talk about it. Do you want to talk about it?
Sure.
Okay, Virginia Giuffre is the woman that Donald Trump is referred to talking to at Jeffrey Epstein's house. Do you know how she got to the employ of Jeffrey Epstein? She worked for Donald Trump. She worked at Mar-a-Lago, and Epstein stole her away, according to Trump, and hired her out from under Trump. So she goes over, and so would it surprise you if a young lady who used to work for Donald Trump when Donald Trump was still friends with Epstein in the early 2000s, that when he would go to Epstein's house, would it surprise you if he spent time talking to her?
Lars, you're the guy that told me...
See, he doesn't want to answer questions. I ask questions, I answer questions. George does not, but good try, George.
The Lars Larson.
9 3 6
seconds, we'll be on the air. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network for almost 30 years providing honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Glad to have you with me. We'll get to your phone calls and emails here in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll, which you'll find at Lars Larson Show on X. And of course, if you're a naysayer, you get to go first. So the government right now is spending huge amounts of taxpayer money to destroy family farms. Now, the guy who knows best about this is the man I've invited on the show, Dylan Honkoop, who is with Save Family Farming. Dylan, welcome back to the program. And tell me what it is that you've found or that somebody has found in these documents about how much money is being spent to try to essentially blame farms for groundwater contamination.
Well, I don't even want to give an estimate as to the total amount of money, because the court cases are staggering. They've been going on for over a decade against these farms that we're talking about in Yakima's lower valley area. But one quote-unquote expert, and I use that term loosely, that we found via public disclosure, was paid over $200,000 to say in court that these farms are polluting. This professor is from 2,000 miles away in Wisconsin, an environmental studies professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They paid her $215,800 to file a declaration in court using, you know, no study of the area, never visiting the farms, none of that, just using generic textbook information to blame these dairies for polluting the groundwater there. Now, Lars, I don't know about you, but if I see somebody who's paid over $200,000 to say something,
yep,
I start to have some questions immediately about this.
I mean, because I know people are going to think about this, say, well, she should get paid for her time. They should probably, if she flies out to testify or writes a document, you can pay her for a few hours of her work. But I'm guessing that university professors, not even the ones at Harvard, get a couple of $100,000 for a couple of hours of work. And then if you say, well, why should we be suspicious of that? If this is her specialty, in other words, this is what she teaches about and presumably does research as a university professor, she'd be able to say, yeah, I've done that research and I've looked at the documents, spent a few hours on that. Now I need $200,000 if you want me to say that. To me, it sounds like they were buying the testimony they wanted as opposed to simply paying. And by the way, her last name is Larson, but no relation. University of Wisconsin-Madison professor Rebecca Larson got paid $215,800 to make a statement. That seems like a ridiculous amount of money unless you just treat a university professor the way you would any other paid expert. If I pay them enough money, they'll come in and testify whatever I want them to testify.
Apparently, that's the way our system of justice works, according to these people. it's really hard to sit back and watch this as taxpayer money is spent at this level to lambast and attack these farmers in court. It's pushed, it started over 10 years ago with four farms. Three of them are already out of business. Only one remains. Multiple of them are still on the hook. Now they're trying to force them to pay millions upon millions to clean up, because they say there are environmental contamination sites. There were farms where they have cows. People have been doing this for a long, long time, but no, because they have this, again, air quotes, expert, they say they were producing pollution in the groundwater. But $200,000, you know, I talked with an expert on this on my program. He's a forensic environmental contamination expert. He's been doing this for over four decades. I didn't tell him the number. I just asked him, you know, for what she produced. He reviewed the document. He poked all kinds of holes in it, said there was all kinds of problems. I said, even if it was right, how much would you get paid to do something like this? He said, oh, $8,000-$10,000 maybe. And then I told him what she paid for it, and I can't repeat the things he said after that. I couldn't believe it, and he said it was insane.
Well, in fact, it sounds like one of those ways that our federal government, just as we found out that USAID was a way of funneling money to particular people or groups that were going to be willing to support the positions of the left. Now, if people are doing it on the right, I'd be just as happy to criticize them as well. But the impact of these farms, I mean, I understand where they say the nitrates are coming from, but essentially it sounds like the people who are against this stuff, they want all farming to stop. I mean, the other place I know of where they're going after nitrate contamination is potato growers. And you say, well, how do you go after potato growers? And you say, well, they harvest the potatoes. They slice off the outside skin. They wash them up. They turn them into McDonald's hash browns and stuff like that. And the Northwest produces a huge quantity of potatoes, potato chips, you know, fries, hash browns and all that. Well, what do they do with the wastewater? They're actually very good. They recycle the wastewater back in. But there are bits of potatoes left in it, you know, skin and all that stuff. And it goes back in the ground. You say, that's a great way to put those nutrients back in the ground. Yeah. And then they say, oh, but it causes excess nitrates in groundwater and we have to stop it. Is there any way to stop it short of just saying, then stop farming and stop having dairies?
Nitrate is the thing that makes plants grow.
So if you go to the big box store, people pay a lot of money for big plastic bags full of fertilizer. Read the front of it. Nitrates are a big chunk of what's in there.
And if you're talking about what's happening in the top 6 inches of a soil, it's a far cry from what's happening 80, 100, 200, sometimes even farther underground. It takes decades oftentimes for that stuff to travel that far, if any of it ever makes it. The science is not clear cut whatsoever until they pony up over $200,000 to get a scientist to say that, which is what they want to hear. Make no mistake, this isn't just about these farms in the lower Yakima Valley. Essentially what they're trying to do through this litigation is to set new policy nationally for these issues, so then they can go after dairies all over the United States. And that's what's really going on here and why they're chomping at the bit, writing huge checks to people 2,000 miles away to try to, again, air quotes, prove that these farms they don't like are polluting. It really starts to make you jaded about our system. And
it really does, because
deck against farmers.
Dylan Honkoop is with Save Family Farming, because what happens is you make milk more expensive, you make all milk products more expensive, you make meat more expensive, because ultimately, if you listen to the people on the far left when it comes to food, they don't want you eating meat. They want you to live like a cow. They want you to eat grain. And you say, what, you know, like soybeans, and they want you to eat, you know, tofu or something. Yeah. That's what they want you on. They do not want you eating meat. They don't want you to be drinking milk. They don't want you to have Tillamook ice cream or anything like that. They want to shut the whole thing down. Dylan, thanks very much. That's Dylan Honkoop at Save Family Farming. Back in a moment. I will get to your phone calls and emails. I got a call earlier from a gentleman who really wanted to go after me on Epstein. Oh, you're going to run cover. No, actually, I planned an entire segment to talk about the Epstein emails and how much of a nothing burger they really are. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The risks and rewards of remote work.
Where are you now?
I'm sitting in my office.
I doubt that.
Why would you doubt that?
If you were in your office right now, we'd be having this conversation face to face.
At least woke progressives won't stop you from listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk for just a moment about the Epstein emails, and I mean just a moment. This is so easily dismissed because the Democrats are absolutely desperate to find anything they can pin on Donald Trump. So what do they have now? They have some emails that came out at the time of Jeffrey Epstein's sentencing for the crimes he was convicted of and sentenced for in 2008. Now, when had Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein known each other? From the 1990s until about 2004. Had they had much to say to each other between 04, when they broke off their friendship, and 08, when Epstein was convicted of those crimes? No. So what do the emails say? They say, Donald Trump spent hours at my house with one of Epstein's victims. Well, do you know who that victim turned out to be? That would be Virginia Giuffre. Now, Virginia Giuffre sadly died. She was one of the victims. She was very vocal. She wrote a book about it. She even testified under oath about what had happened involving Jeffrey Epstein. Now, she was asked about Donald Trump. She said Donald Trump never knew about what was going on. So either you believe that the late Virginia Giuffre perjured herself and lied under oath, and now the Democrats know they can say why he spent time with one of Epstein's victims at the house. Except that very woman, Virginia Giuffre, under oath had already cleared Donald Trump. And the other question I always ask people about this, because there are lots of people, there was a gentleman called the show and said, you're going to run cover for him. I don't know, is this running cover? If the Democrats at any point in the last 10 years, going back to 2015, when Trump announced he would run for president, if they had had dirt on Donald Trump, about things that happened in the early 2000s or in the 1990s involving Jeffrey Epstein's crimes against children, if any Democrat in the United States had had anything that they could hang their hat on to say Donald Trump was involved in evil doings involving sex with children, you're telling me that they held all this back for 10 years and are only now launching it? Or are they launching this one because they know you can't rebut it because the woman who under oath cleared Donald Trump is now dead? So they're going to use her dead, one of the victims of Jeffrey Epstein, who cleared Donald Trump and said, nope, he had nothing to do with it. So if anybody's got a better argument, I'd be glad to take the naysayer call at 866-HEY-LARS. Let me go first to Jennifer, who is a naysayer. Jennifer, you know we love naysayers on this program. Welcome. Thank you for calling. What do you and I disagree about? Jennifer? Jennifer? Well, we'll try and come back to her later. I like putting naysayers first. Let's go to Lloyd. Hey, Lloyd, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind, sir?
Good afternoon, Lars.
Lars.
I almost forgot your name.
Lord. Yeah, well, it's a really forgettable name, let me tell you.
No, I was calling you something else.
Long as not late for dinner.
Yeah, your screener Joel was very polite, and I asked your screener Joel if you've ever heard of the term cattle call in regard to actors showing up for an audition. Well, there's like a big movie or TV show going on, and
okay, but Lloyd, I appreciate you mentioning Joel. He's a great young man, but what's the point you're trying to make?
Okay, the original topic, Lars, was food stamps, non-alcoholic beer. I believe that non-alcoholic beer should be allowed with food stamps the same as Coke and Pepsi.
Why?
That's my
How about this? How about we say on food stamps you can buy real food? You can buy bread, milk, butter, meat, vegetables, and nothing else. No soda pop, no near beer, no none of that. Why would, if somebody has told me they're short on groceries, which is what SNAP is supposed to do for people, it is supposed to supplement their budget. That's why it's called SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
Right.
You're assisting. You're not giving them their entire budget. Why should somebody be allowed to buy any kind of junk, whether it's near beer or potato chips or anything else, using food stamps, if they're so short of money for food that they need help, how could they be spending that food stamp money on junk?
Okay. Well, it's just the fact that as the way it is, Lars, Coke and Pepsi are allowed, and Dr. Pepper.
You can name off every soda pop in the world. I get the point, Lloyd. I would wipe all those things off the list and say, since we're supplementing your budget, you can buy real food with the EBT, and whatever you want to spend your money on for junk, go ahead. Spend your own money on junk. You find that people safeguard their own money a lot better than they do SNAP benefits in many cases. Let's go to Wayne, who's an ace here. Hey, Wayne, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
A few days ago, Lars, you was talking about a lady that had a boyfriend, and she was embarrassed, and you said she shouldn't be.
No. What I said was that it was an ex-poll question based on an article that a woman had written saying that there are many people, young women, on social media who say they are embarrassed to even admit that they have a boyfriend or that he exists. And so in many cases, weirdly enough, I mean, most of us, I talk about Tina from time to time, and I wouldn't be embarrassed to do so. But apparently in the modern age, there are a lot of young women who have a boyfriend, have had a boyfriend for years, but they never admit it to their friends on social media for some bizarre reason that has to do with admitting you have a boyfriend puts you on the path to being what they call a trad wife or something like that. That's what we talked about. And I said, should young women on social media have to be ashamed or embarrassed about having a boyfriend? And I said, no.
Well, I say yes.
Why should they be embarrassed by having a boyfriend?
Because they should have a man friend. One of our big problems in society right now is too many boyfriends.
Do you mean that when an adult says while, when an adult woman says she has a boyfriend that people think she means a child?
Well, boyfriends are for high school.
Well, okay, what is a 25-year-old woman, how does a 25-year-old woman refer to the man she spends time with, goes to dinner with, might someday marry? How should she refer to him?
As a man friend.
Doesn't that seem kind of awkward? Okay, then instead of girlfriend, I should have called Tina my woman friend back in the day, 30 years ago.
Your lady friend.
Well, I get an awful lot of ladies who apparently don't like the term lady, and I don't understand why. I thought lady was a polite reference.
Well, that's fine.
Would you like to meet my woman friend, Tina? Wouldn't that sound kind of awkward?
Woman friend, yeah, I don't like the sound of that.
How about I get technical? I could say, this is my female friend, and I am her male friend.
Well, yeah, or my double X chromosome friend.
Oh, say double X chromosome friend.
One of the problems, one of the problems with boyfriends, too many of them disappear after fathering a couple of children and leave the lady.
Well, then we call them deadbeat scumbags, don't we?
Exactly.
I would say so. Thank you for the call, Wayne. Good, interesting naysayer call. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Are you experiencing technical difficulties?
That electrician must be a Democrat.
No technical difficulties here. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, the FBI secretly spied on Republican senators' cell phones, and now Congress just gave them all, well, eight of them or so, the right to sue for about $500,000 each against Jack Smith. Is that justice or just a Band-Aid, or does it make any sense at all? I thought that's where we'd start today, because my conversations with Leland Vittert tend to go all over the boards. Leland is, of course, the host of On Balance and Chief Washington anchor at News Nation. Leland, welcome back.
Always good to be here, my friend.
Is this a good idea for the Congress to pass a law saying you senators can sue this one person? It almost sounds like a bill of attainder to me.
It totally does. I can't figure out who included it. I'm sure that it'll be pretty easy to figure out why said person went and included it. This sounds like basically like a payoff, right?
Yeah.
That
it does.
Senators put in for themselves, because we already know that it's happened, and therefore it's basically saying if this happened to you, you can sue and get $500,000 that's in this bill. It feels just sort of pathetically transparent to me.
Yep.
And silly and wrong. And the other thing is this whole idea of suing from maybe the first time I'm just looking up, maybe the first time I ever agreed with Hakeem Jeffries, who's called this a corrupt cash bonus, which is basically what it is. The idea of suing the government, right, that somehow then it's going to change government's behavior is laughable.
Yep.
Because the people who end up paying are not those who are responsible for the behavior. You know, if you say something untrue about Leland Vittert and I sue you, you pay. Therefore, you have an incentive not to say something bad about Leland Vittert.
Right.
If I am an FBI agent, on the other hand, or a police officer, and I beat you, and then you sue the department, well, the department pays. You don't. Your behavior isn't changed by it. Now, maybe it affects that the chief gets fired and the new chief decides he's going to quit. But it's silly. I mean, that's the whole point of this is they're all just it's transparently bad.
I mean, because at the end of the day, if these folks had, if this had not been included in the bill and they had just brought a lawsuit, then I assume Jack Smith would have said, I have qualified immunity because I'm a government agent, except that then that might bring up the question of whether or not he was legally appointed as special counsel. But giving them the special privilege of suing when lots of Americans have been spied on by the government at various levels, maybe not as bad as this example of the 8 GOP senators, but all of us have the right to go to court if we want to and try and sue the government, although good luck with that. So giving them this special privilege, I wish I could figure out. Tell that producer of yours, Cynthia Rutt, to get busy looking up that information.
Okay. Well, by the way, it's giving themselves the right to sue. I'm trying to think of, like, it'd be as if I, like, went on my show and said, you know, I now declare I have the right to demand from my producers whatever that enriches me. It's a very odd, I guess the best thing would be like, it's like a CEO saying, you know, to a CEO in January declaring, well, you know, if our sales last year were X, then I get a bonus. And they were X, so therefore he declares that he gets himself a bonus. Okay.
That almost sounds like the old Soviet system where they would project a 60 billion bushel harvest of wheat, and they always knew they were going to run short. And then afterwards, the government would go back and rewrite the numbers and say, no, we only projected 40 billion bushels, so we were right on target.
Well, that's kind of that. How you get a balanced budget in D.C., right?
Yeah, just go back and back balance. By the way, let me add, this came up just today. Trump has said he's going to sue the BBC. And frankly, I think what the BBC did was absolutely egregious when they said, we're going to take one soundbite from the front of a speech and another soundbite from an hour later, marry them together in a way the audience can't detect, and make somebody say something they're not saying. To me, when a news organization does that, especially one with the supposed reputation of the BBC, there has to be some kind of justice for the person who's, you know, who's the center of that accusation. And that's Trump in this case. So he says he may sue them for $1 billion. And I guess he's moving ahead with that. What should we make of that and all the other suits that Trump has brought, many of them successfully settled against major news organizations in America?
When we start going down the line of politicians suing news organizations, especially presidents, it is a dangerous place to be. Because, Lars, there is going to the shoe will always be on the other foot.
True.
There are going to be Democrats who are presidents, and they are going to sue people like you.
Yep.
Because they don't like how you played their sound bites, or they don't like what you said about them. I am of the opinion that if you want to be president of the United States, and if you are president of the United States, that is a job that inherently comes with thick skin, or should. I can't really imagine Thomas Jefferson or George Washington or Abraham Lincoln suing news organizations that they didn't like. That to me feels a lot like punching down. Okay. And I think when conservatives are excited about it, they should just remember it's going to happen to them.
See, I agree with you about the thick skin, but here's the difference, Leland. In this case, the BBC was trying to affect the outcome of an election. And I think that's where the lawsuit might be actually in defense of America's system of representative government. When a foreign national news organization, whether it's Great Britain or China or Russia or whoever, tries to influence the point of view of Americans, right before an election, that they're actually attacking us in a way that really can't be answered. So having thick skin means if somebody says he has orange hair, or he's heavier than he should be, or he's been married to a bunch of people or whatever, that's the thick skin part. What do you do when they actually attack our representative form of government and say, we're going to change your election, and
Russia's been trying to do that. Our enemies have been trying to do that since the formation of the republic, and we've tried to do that to other countries since the formation of the republic.
And we should stop.
Okay, well, I don't think so. But I think that's just world affairs. But number one, I don't really care. Number two, again, when you have a president, and it's, remember, not just suing foreign news organizations, it was suing CBS and suing ABC and everything else, it starts to feel very much like a shakedown. And let me be the first, mark the tape. when whoever is the next Democratic president decides to sue Fox News because they don't like how Fox edited sound bites or played videos.
Yeah.
Just imagine if Joe Biden sued Fox News because they said, well, the video that you edited of him wandering around was deceptively edited. And you cherry picked what part of the video you took.
That'd be a legit. Now, I got to get one last question, Leland. Wouldn't a copy of Born Lucky be a great Christmas present or a discussion starter for the Thanksgiving dinner table?
It would be, and I know that because of how many hundreds of people have written me emails thanking me for writing it about my dad's journey to adapt me to the world rather than the world to me when I was diagnosed with autism. And it is a message of hope and power for every parent of a kid having a hard time. Don't do it while you're driving, or make it really easy. Go to bornlucky.com.
And that's very easy. Bornlucky.com. Its author is Leland Vittert. You find him at News Nation. And Leland, it's a pleasure to have you on. Back in a moment, we'll get to your phone calls and emails and naysayer calls, too. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Favorite color is gold.
I can proudly proclaim that the golden age of America is upon us.
Sit back and enjoy. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and we serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And we always say that we put naysayers to the head of the line, and in 27 plus years, we have never varied from that rule. So I want to go to James first, who is a naysayer. James, welcome to the program. Thanks for the call. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer today?
How you doing, Lars? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I disagree with your take with the Epstein, saying, I think you had a caller come in and said you're kind of covering up for it. So I kind of feel like that the Republicans are covering up for the Epstein, just the same way the Democrats covered up for Joe Biden. And I guess that's where my disappointment of listening to the show is, because I'd rather you say you're honest talk radio.
Honestly provocative talk, yeah. But James, can I ask you a couple of questions? What was it that the most common accusation against Joe Biden was that his brain was starting to not function and he was not fully there? Did that turn out to be true?
Oh, yes, definitely true.
Okay, then that's dealt with. So that's why Republicans, I know there's a tendency to say, well, both sides do it. You accuse Joe Biden of stuff. Yeah, and it turned out to be true. He was so incompetent, his own party kicked him to the curb. So let's go to Trump. Tell me what it is that you think, how Trump is implicated in anything by these emails. Just tell me.
Okay, I'll tell you that, but go back to what you said about Biden. Reason why you say, is it true? Yes, it's true, but the cover-up comes, and then you get the truth behind it. Like, so Democrats cover it up for Biden, and then it comes out, even though most of us saw it. And then it comes out. So when it comes to Trump, it's the cover-up is what's going on with Epstein. So the names come out. So the names come out, and Trump's name becomes a part of it.
James, I've known people who later got convicted of crimes. Was I involved in those crimes? Not at all. And I'll bet you've probably known one or two people in your life who did something that was wrong. Have you ever known somebody or been related to somebody who was convicted of a crime?
Yes.
James, both of us are in the same boat. Does the fact that you knew them or were related to them, does that mean you were involved in that crime?
Well, if you're complicit, if you know and still...
We'll get to that in a second. I'm just saying, but there are people who believe that Donald Trump committed crimes against children. Now, do you know who says he didn't? The young women who were the victims of Jeffrey Epstein. So why, I guess I'd ask you this, two logical questions. One, if one of those young women could implicate Donald Trump, would that be a powerful piece of information that might even get you a book deal, a movie deal, a big check from Donald Trump, a lot of attention from the media? Would that be a valuable piece of information if you could say it?
Sure.
Okay. Yes. Now, the most prominent is mentioned in these emails, but only as victim, but we know who she was. The one that Jeffrey Epstein in this newest document dump from the Democrats, who are just desperate to get something on Trump, is that the late Jeffrey Epstein, who did not commit suicide, he at the time of his sentencing was talking to Ghislaine Maxwell and his lawyers, and he said, look, Trump talked to this woman, the victim, at my home for hours. Okay, fine. Do you know the woman's name is Virginia Giuffre? She has sadly passed away, but she wrote a book about what happened. She testified about what happened. And do you know what she said about Donald Trump?
Yes, she said, he was a very nice guy.
She cleared him 100% under oath. So you got that. So if she knew something that would implicate Donald Trump, was there any downside to announcing it to the world?
Well, it depends. A lot of people will announce stuff, come up somehow suicide is the
no point. only if you're talking about the Clintons. With the Clintons, if you say something about them, you may end up dead, but with Trump, no. So there would have been a tremendous upside, you'd agree, that if Virginia Giuffre could have said Donald Trump had sex with children, that would have been book deal, interviews, TV deal, lots of attention, lots of accolades for the mainstream media. She had no downside to saying it. She had only upside, and yet she cleared him. Why would that be?
Okay, so you're right. This is the issue I have with this, Lars, is that I believe that both sides, Democrats and Republicans, are using, the Democrats, yes, could probably be using this for focusing on Trump. Republicans who want to protect Trump or want to cover up or protect Trump. Now, the problem I have is that it's really not, when I look at this situation, and it should be with all of us who look at this situation, take Trump out of it. The fact that we have powerful people who were involved in a huge sex trafficking and affecting kids, and there's still victims out there, those victims are no longer getting their voices heard.
I agree. And James, any of those victims...
I have with this.
No, I do too. And if you listen to the show, I've said I want all the other people, Jeffrey Epstein's friends, who got children from him to use for sex, they need to be investigated. If the evidence is there, they need to be prosecuted. And I don't care if they're Republicans or Democrats. Last quick question, James, because we're close to the break. Huh? If anybody, you say, I'm concerned Trump may have been implicated. If the Democrats thought they could have implicated Donald Trump at any point in the last 10 years in this, would they have?
I think they have it, because if they open that door, Lars, I believe that there's so many powerful people above that.
In other words, the Democrats are keeping the evil secret of Donald Trump and children. That's an interesting one. You got the Lars Larson Show. Good night.
The Lars Larson Show.
Hey, hey.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get you your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And as always, when I disagree with something President Trump is doing or talking about, I'm glad to tell you what my disagreement is. And right now, the Trump administration says it is working on a plan to make 50-year home mortgages a reality. And I think that is a colossally foolish idea, and I'll say so. I mean, even though it's coming from a president that I support and a president I voted for, I think this is an exceptionally bad idea. I also think that it's not really going to be a game changer for the group that the Trump administration says it's addressing, which is younger Americans who'd like to be able to buy homes. And if anything, it may be a bit of a disincentive, and we'll talk about that. I've invited Nick Shivers on, who's one of the many great supporters of this program, with his real estate business called the Nick Shivers Team. Nick, how many homes have you sold in the last 20 years, would you estimate?
Oh, I think not bragging, but we've sold a lot, Lars, like let's say over 5,000.
Okay, let's say over 5,000. And I would imagine the majority of those were sold on a 30-year mortgage. Probably a few went for 15s or 10s.
Yes.
And there were probably a few people who had the kind of dough that I don't have, and I don't even know if you have that, to walk in and say, I'll just write a check for the whole thing. And there were probably a few of those. Do 50-year mortgages make any sense?
I guess you would have to answer that, Lars, by depending on who you're talking to. So here's my thing. I have lots of people, and this isn't my take on this. I'm kind of with you. I don't necessarily like it, but there's a lot of people in this industry, smart people, that think it's a good idea. So let's look at the pros and cons. If you are a first-time home buyer in certain areas, Lars, real estate, just like real estate is hyper-local, I think for certain people in certain areas, like where there's a lot of supply, first-time home buyers, it would help. And why I say that is if you're in Portland right now or Clark County or any of the Portland metro area, it's not that we don't have first-time home buyers that are wanting to buy. It's there's still not enough supply out there. So we still see multiple offers on properties under 400 all the time. We had 13 offers on one property this weekend. So I think it also helps sellers, because I do, Lars, believe that it will bring because the real estate market's been in a recession since 2022, meaning just not the lowest amount of transactions because of affordability. That being said, if we look at inventory levels, Lars, in June, July, we're at 7% interest rates. We're at 33% higher inventory from the year before.
Right.
When interest rates went down below 6.5, we're at 6.25 right now. We're only 15.4% of inventory from year over year. So the market is moving, and I like, because of the mortgage rate and cutting red tape, that will move the market. I don't think we have to jump in, because That could potentially, if we had mortgage rates go down and this, I think we could see another acceleration.
But that's two different things. But, Nick, if somebody is going to finance a 50-year mortgage, are there even any companies right now that are willing to say, we'll loan you the money on 50-year terms?
No, this is just good talking points as we speak. That could happen for sure, Lars, and it would. And it would be backed by the government. So that's another.
But then you get to a second question. Nick, if I came to you as a generic person, I've worked with you before, and I said, I'm thinking of a 30-year mortgage. But, Nick, if I went to a 20 or a 15 or a 10, would I likely get a lower interest rate?
You would get a lower interest rate, and you would build wealth a lot more quickly.
Okay, then the second question is, if I can lower my interest rate by borrowing on shorter-term money, does that mean it works the opposite way when you go from 30 to 40 to 50?
Let's look at the car industry, Lars. They went from 36 months, and now you can stretch it out to 84 months. And what's happening in the car industry? It has the highest level of default. Why? Because not everyone should buy a new car, and not everyone, and this is, I get yelled at all the time, not everyone should buy a house.
Because it's a commitment. I mean, if you rent and then you say, wow, gee, I need to move, I need to go somewhere else, or I just don't like this apartment, or I'm paying too much in rent, you can say, then I'll move. But oftentimes, there are people right now who might want to move, but they can't sell their house. So to some extent, it's kind of like being married to a property versus renting a property. Renting a property, you can decide to end the rental agreement at some point. But with a house, you got to sell it, and you may have to sell it at a loss. And if you sell it at, you know, depending on where the market is and everything else. So, but all I'm wondering is if the interest rate goes down as you go down in years. So a 10-year mortgage is usually at a lower rate than a 30. Then does that mean a 40 or 50 is going to be at a higher rate? Which means if the difference between a 30-year mortgage and a 50 is maybe 10% of the monthly payment, but I'm paying at a higher rate, could we literally end up with somebody agreeing to 50 and their payment is just as high or close to as high?
All the analysis said that wouldn't be the case. It would be about a $300 difference on a $400,000 house.
Okay.
That being said, Lars, it just because you have lower payments doesn't mean the property's going to be cheaper. The fact is, I think it would spur the market and we would see appreciation come back above where we are right now, which is anywhere from 1 to 3%.
And the other thing is, Nick, when you, and I understand most houses appreciate in value, but if you walk in and say, I want to buy a car on that 84-month terms, in many cases, unless you're putting down a whopping big down payment, you are likely to be upside down in that vehicle, or your car is worth exactly what you owe on it the day you decide to have to sell it, unless you go all the way the full 84 months and pay it off. Is the same thing going to be true, that you're going to build equity in the house more slowly if you have a 50-year mortgage?
100%, because majority of those payments, Lars, at the start would all be interest. And remember this, anybody that bought a house and pretty much anywhere in the country, Portland Metro, California, Florida, if you bought a house, except maybe Midwest, Northeast, Midwest area, if you bought a house late 2022 with an interest rate of 6.5% to 7%, you might not have any equity right now.
Wow.
On a 30-year.
Wow. Does that mean we're going to see more defaults in the mortgage business if we go to a 50-year loan?
I would say just look at when you went from a 36-year, and it's different, but 36-year term, a 36-month term on car loans to an 84-month, and see. I would look at that. I think there is a direct correlation with that, 100%, sure.
And you know what, Nick, to sign it off, I honestly believe that what they'll do is they'll qualify more people. And many of those people will be just what you suggested, the people who say, I want to buy it on that 50-year mortgage. And a few years in, they think, I'm strapped to this thing. I want to get out of it. And they may find out they're going to have to walk away at a loss. That's a bad deal. That is Nick Shivers, one of the supporters of this program, with his real estate business, the Nick Shivers Team. Back in a moment.
Lars' daily question to all the Dems in our government.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Now, the one with the brain, Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your calls. You know, one of the things that Democrats have said over and over again lately is that guns are the number one killer of kids in America, and it makes a great bumper sticker. The only problem with that bumper sticker is it's 100% false, and I want to dig into the numbers and show you why it's false. Because at the end of the day, whether gun deaths among children are a serious concern, of course they are. But the Democrats like to say it. Why? It has become the number one leading cause of death among children. And nobody knows that better than my friend John Lott, who heads up the Crime Prevention Research Center. I serve on the board of directors of that center, uncompensated, by the way. And I'm glad to do that because I think it's important to put together the numbers to actually show whether or not Democrats are telling the truth. For example, the Commonwealth of Virginia and its new governor-elect. And I don't know how in the world Virginia was dumb enough to elect Abigail Spanberger, but she's demanding new gun control laws. And she actually says the number one killer of kids in America is guns. And it is provably untrue. Now, if they're going to make that claim and say this is the thing that kills kids more than automobiles, more than drugs, more than anything else, then it ought to be at least true. Let me get into the details of that in just a moment, and I'll tell you what the Crime Prevention Research Center and Dr. John Lott has put out. And if you want the link to all that information, I'd be glad to supply it to you. Send an email to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. And if you want to send the email talk@LarsLarson, you can also vote on our website at LarsLarson.com or on X. We put up a daily poll question that's written from the news of the day, and you're free to vote any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show. But the problem is, Lott points out that the mainstream media has done over the last decade or so a real drumbeat. And it always goes the same way. Quote, here's a Washington Post headline. Why guns are America's number one killer of children. NPR, you know, the formerly government-funded public broadcasting that tilts hard to the left. Firearms overtook auto accidents as the leading cause of death in children. And the BBC, you know, they're in trouble now. They're going to get sued by Trump. Gun deaths were the leading killer of children in of U.S. children in 2020. Now, the problem is that a lot of the fact checkers look at that and say, yeah, the numbers are bigger. Here's part of the problem. How do you define a child? I think for most people, you'd say adults are those over the age of 18 and children are those under the age of 18. So for 2023, the numbers were essentially tied between vehicle deaths, 2580, and for firearms, 2581. And yet, those numbers make them look closer than they really are, and I'll tell you why. I know that somebody out there is saying, Lars is about to play games with numbers. No, I'm just going to tell you what it is. When you exclude justified killings, and what do we mean by that? Well, if the police respond to a crime, and they are presented with a threat, and they shoot at the person who's presenting the threat, and they kill them, is that what you would consider the death of a child? If the person is 15 or 16 years old, that would be a child. But it makes it sound as though guns, because they're in the wrong hands, that's why they're asking for gun control, that somehow that's the take out justified killings and use the FBI's own numbers for murders instead. The firearms total drops by more than 400 from 2581 children to 2166. And then consider which children are involved in those firearms homicides. Almost three quarters, 72% of firearms homicides, including involving minors, occurred among 15, 16, and 17-year-olds. 16 and 17-year-olds make up a majority of those deaths. And the killings overwhelmingly stem, as John Lott points out, from gang activity, even though a total gun ban would do not much to stop the gangs from getting weapons. So if what you have is gang warfare, in which gangs who are involved in criminal activity, if you think that gun laws are going to stop people who are involved in law-breaking activity, I think you're mistaken. And Lott points out, even if you classify 17-year-old gang members as children, the gun control claim doesn't hold up. He points out that in 2019 and 2020, more children died from suffocation than from firearms. And the two causes were almost equal in 2022 and 2023. Then, if you actually look at what most people think of as children, those under the age of 15, motor vehicle deaths far exceed firearms deaths. From 2019 through 2023, deaths involving cars were 64% to 153% higher than firearms deaths. Homicides and murders of those under the age of 18 have risen around America after 2020, after the pandemic. Democrats blame that on guns, even though that argument's a little bit silly, because by 2020, Americans owned literally hundreds of millions of guns. So if you said, but we have more gun control laws, we make it harder for somebody to go out and buy a gun. There are hundreds of millions of guns in America. What other factor could be causing homicides and murders of those under the age of 18 to go up? Well, you had an awful lot of cities and states that decided to defund the police starting in 2020 with the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. So you say, well, then that is probably the cause for that rise. Could it be that if we went from, say, 400 million guns in private ownership, I can't remember, honestly, I'd have to look it up, how many guns are sold in an average year. But it's a tiny fraction of the 400 million already in private hands. So if you say, if those numbers aren't going up, and frankly, during the Obama years, Obama was one of the best gun sellers in America. He made Americans so scared that an awful lot of people, and I would include myself in that group, went out and bought firearms because we figured at some point Obama is going to go to his friends in the Congress and he's going to try to pass gun control. He never actually did. I mean, he talked about gun control a lot, but even when Obama had the presidency and he had both houses of Congress, he didn't go and pass gun control. And why? Because he knew that that was a terrible issue and it was going to be politically damaging when he ran for re-election in 2012. And, of course, he won in 2012. The United Kingdom banned handguns in January of 1997. And do you know what happened? The homicide rate went up by 50% for the following 8 years. The rate returned to earlier levels only after they increased police by 14%. So if you say, Lawrence, I don't want anybody to be killed in an unjustified way, whether they're a child or an adult. You want that to happen? Hire more cops. And by the way, suicide is about 35% of all firearms deaths. And yet, you know which country has the number one suicide rate in the world? That would be South Korea, a society very similar to the United States. And private gun ownership is not allowed, not at all. So if you tell me that guns are the problem with suicides, I suggest you talk to somebody in South Korea. Glad to have you with me. Glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Does Lars finally agree with Chuck Schumer?
Of course there's some wasteful spending, but you don't use a meat axe and cut everything.
Pass out the chainsaws and welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And I
got my chainsaw. Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Well, Donald Trump hosted Syria's new leader at the White House. And why is that notable? Well, Syria got its independence from France in 1946. I know, that long ago. And the first time that a head of state from Syria has visited the White House, it's the first time since 1946, since Syria became independent from France. So it's been a long, long time. But there's something about that leader from Syria, the brand new Syrian president, Ahmad al-Sharaa, is a former member of Al-Qaeda, which has raised a few eyebrows. So I thought we'd talk about it with Laura Karch, who is a senior contributor at Young Voices. Laura, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Lars.
So what should we know about this guy? And I guess the question comes down to, if he used to be allied with Al-Qaeda, but now he heads up the state because they overturned the presidency of Bashar al-Assad last December, and he's the interim leader, he was named that in January, is this a guy that we should say, well, he was once a revolutionary, and now he's becoming a bureaucrat, or should we be concerned about having a former Al-Qaeda coming to visit Donald Trump of the White House?
Well, as you said, there are some huge risks and implications for engaging with this guy, right? I mean, he ran during the Syrian civil war a town called Idlib, and it was all under Sharia law. So there is a credibility risk for the U.S. right now in essentially partnering with a quote-unquote reformed extremist. So it should be interesting. I think the world is just watching and waiting to see if this guy is really what he says he is and wants to reform the country. And, you know, focusing on the human rights and executing, especially with the recent persecutions that are happening internally in the country right now between minorities such as the Alawites, Jews, and Christians, all against the government. So it's really just a waiting game at this point.
So how has al-Sharia treated Christians in that country? Because for the longest time, there's been a real war on Christians in Syria, hasn't there?
Correct, yes. There's huge sectarian violence, actually, and in my opinion, a brewing civil war going on right now, which, you know, began as a natural consequence of the ousting of the previous administration, the Assad administration, and given the vacuum that was created, it began, I believe, in March 2025, where the Alawites were persecuted, and then there was the infamous Soweto conflict between the government forces and the Druze as well. This is where Israel got involved and bombed Damascus as a warning, actually. And, you know, since then, there's been some fighting between the Kurds, SDF, YPG, and the government forces this past October in Aleppo. You know, there has been a truce since then ongoing, but I believe that tensions are still brewing. So.
Well, I'm talking to Laura Karch, who's a senior contributor at Young Voices, I guess from a distance, because I... Look, if I pretended to understand all the conflicts that are going on in Syria, I'd be a liar. But if I see Trump do something like this and he says, okay, we'll bring the guy in, and then he understands I may be welcomed into places like the White House, but if I go back to Syria and I do things that are going to put the United States in a bad light because of that, then the U.S. is just as capable of cutting ties with the guy, aren't we?
Correct. Yes, I would agree with that.
So is this, so does that suggest that this is a good strategy of Trump? Because it's certainly bold. I mean, Syria hasn't had a head of state come to the White House in its entire existence.
Oh, most definitely. It's definitely a bold move. I believe it's a loud one. And in my opinion, it's very irresponsible because, again, there's a huge human rights cost right now going on internally in Syria, and there's a bunch of volatility. So I think cozying up too quickly to this new leader would ignite the sectarian backlash even more. And quite frankly, it's undermining our moral standing as the United States and, you know, leader of the world.
Okay, so why did Trump do it? Do you have any insights on that?
I believe from a realistic perspective, if the U.S. is able to have a relationship with the new Syrian leader, we can, you know, essentially get whatever we want done in the region, including our new base that we're building. As you know, the U.S. base number went from 8 total bases now down to 1 in Syria. And, you know, eventually, in regards to the Abraham Accords, I think maybe Trump is trying to play a Syrian membership into the Accords pretty soon, although Sharia expressed some hesitation with that recently. But I do believe it's a huge return on investment in regards to Trump's run for peace president, as we've all heard. And, you know, the last thing would be oil, oil, as the historic of the U.S. interest in the region. And, you know, we still do have troops in the oil bases in Syria for a while now in the north. So again, it's all the very pragmatic relationship, I believe.
But if all Shira has been to the White House, and then Trump, if Shira starts to do things that are out of line by our point of view, then Trump can pick up the phone or whatever method of communication and reach out to the guy and say, hey, you shouldn't be doing that. And maybe we get more attention to that message than we would if Al Shira was told, you're not welcome here.
Right, exactly. So it is a more pragmatic relationship, I would say, to kind of get what we want done, you know, including maybe the appealing to the human rights perspective internally, though it might be difficult to eradicate the extremist mindset for a while. But, you know, I guess engagement is better than none. And I would call for a cautious reengagement with especially this new leader.
Well, because, Laura, one of my big disappointments when Trump left office at the end of his first term and Biden came in, and we can discuss the election another day because I don't think that went right. But one of the huge disappointments for me was we had three deals done under the Abraham Accords, and there were at least four more that were in the offing that might have actually come about. And instead, the Biden administration just basically ignored it, and the media didn't decide to question Biden if there were all these deals that could have been done to bring about some more stability in that region, which has been a problematic region going back to President Jefferson, for God's sake, that why didn't you pursue those? But the media didn't want to question the Biden administration and say, well, why aren't you doing these deals? Trump had most of this stuff underway, and you could sew these deals up. And I think it's because Biden or whoever was actually running the auto pen decided we don't want anything to do with Trump's deals, even though the deals appear to work out well for the countries who are involved in those peace agreements, didn't it?
Right, exactly. And to be honest, I would add that this visit would also curb the threat of Iran's hold in Syria previously. It did have more influence than it does now under Assad, and it does signal a shifting alliance between them, the two. So, you know, it can possibly counteract, you know, people like Iran and Russia in the region as well. So,
well, yeah, because because Laura, yeah, you've got Iran on its lips right now. Trump can squeeze them again the way he did before he left office and before Joe Biden opened up the spigots and basically let the Iranians make about $100 billion on their oil. He could put Iran in an isolated spot and say, you know, nobody wants to deal with you. And by the way, Syria might just end up being one of our good new friends, and you don't get to influence them either. That sounds like it's good for the region.
That would be the ideal. So one would hope.
Well, we'll see what happens. We'll be glad to read more about what you've written about it. Laura Karch is a senior contributor at Young Voices. Laura, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm glad to get you your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our poll on X today, should the U.S. only accept legal immigrants who aren't likely to cost the taxpayers a lot of money for health care? We'll get to that and your phone calls and emails. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Senator John Kennedy with some advice to Schumer and Hakeem.
Chuck and Hakeem need to go to Amazon, buy some testicles, and stand up to the moon wing of their party.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get your calls, and thanks for listening to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past almost 30 years. The poll on X today: should the U.S. only take in legal immigrants who are unlikely to cost taxpayers a lot of money to pay for their health care. I mean, that's always been written into the federal law. The federal laws on immigration that go back decades before Donald Trump say that when you evaluate somebody for, say, a green card, that is a permanent resident alien who has a chance to work his or her way to citizenship, it says the person must demonstrate that they are unlikely to become a public charge. Public charge is the fancy lawyer way of saying they're unlikely to end up on welfare, food stamps, Section 8, Medicaid, and all the rest of that garbage. Well, now the State Department under Donald Trump has sent out a message through a cable to its consular office and says, we want you to evaluate applicants for U.S. visas based on their age or the likelihood that they would need to rely on public benefits. Don't bring a bunch of welfare bums to the United States, seems to be the bottom line message. Now, on that note, let's go to Marcus, who's a naysayer. Marcus, we love naysayers. What do you and I disagree about that makes you one?
So I don't know if I would qualify completely as a naysayer. However, I don't agree with the representation you just painted of the new self-proclaimed leader of Syria. I'm hoping on the best...
What part of it... No, help me out, because I want to know what I did wrong. I said he was a former al-Qaeda. I said he's the head of Syria now, appointed as the interim leader. What part of that did I get wrong?
So, yes, he was a former member of al-Qaeda. However, he was a former al-Qaeda leader who was arrested in 2005, 2006 time frame for carrying out terrorist attacks against the United States.
Right, that's why he had a $10 million bounty on his head. But what's your point? I said he's formerly with al-Qaeda. He appears to be the head of a country now, and the question is, and I'm open to it either way, was it a smart thing for Trump to allow him to come to the White House or not?
So, no, I don't agree that it was a smart thing for him to come to the White House. And I guess, like I was saying, my disagreement was just how you portrayed it, him just saying he was only a member of al-Qaeda. My biggest issue with the entire situation was the date that Trump chose to have him at the White House. He did it on the 250th Marine Corps birthday and a day before veterans. And this was a member that was 20 plus years.
We mentioned the Marine Corps' birthday on the 10th. That's the birthday every year. But what's the significance of bringing him there on the Marine Corps birthday as opposed to Veterans Day, which was the next day, or 2 weeks from now would be in the Thanksgiving week? What does the date mean?
What does the date mean that he brought him to the White House? I couldn't tell you that.
Said you objected to him in particular being there on Monday instead of Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday. What was the significance that it was an especially bad idea to bring him there on that day?
I wouldn't say just Monday, but Monday or Tuesday, period, seeing as how we fought against his organization for the last 20-plus years.
Actually, better than that. If you want to go into Muslim troubles, you can go all the way back to Jefferson.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah,
but
and I get
most
that.
Most recently, with Americans, in right now in our faces in the media, if you're trying to start a relationship with this new government, with a al-Qaeda leader, which I don't believe he is a former, if you look at how he took over Syria, his backing, his partners, where the funding came from, the members that he was fighting alongside with.
Yeah, he was part of the rebel forces that overthrew Bashar Assad, who is nothing to write home about. So how would you suggest that we begin a relationship in which you might have the U.S. telling Syria, knock it off, don't go there? You've got to start some kind of conversation like that. I mean, the alternative is to send cruise missiles, isn't it?
True, that is the alternative. I wouldn't have picked this week of all weeks to start relations and start talks with this new leader. If that was the case, I wouldn't have done it at the Oval Office, period. The symbol of
where would you have had Trump meet him?
Probably another allied country, somewhere where we do deals like this with, go to another NATO country or somewhere else.
Okay, and that's a reasonable point. Thanks for the good naysayers. Let's go to Emily. Emily, you're in Rogue River. We need to get to it quick because we're going to hit the break at the end of the hour. What have you seen at your kid's school?
My daughter is in seventh grade, and she came home and was pretty upset because in one of her classes, the teacher had played a
rape scene, along with the naked man. It was a cartoon form, but it was still in the scene, a ghost holding a girl down so that the king, the naked king, could have his way with his new bride. And
what was the learning part of that? What was the lesson?
It was in a social... they were talking about the barbaric, like the upcoming of the barbaric tribes and whatnot in social studies class. And I just feel there's a lot other ways besides a cartoon video
of a rape.
I understand that happened, but to show it in class, in a seventh grade class, is not okay.
Yeah, there are a lot of bad things that have happened in the world, but having to show them to 12-year-olds seems like an especially bad idea. Send me an email, Emily. I want to know more about that. Thanks a lot for listening. It's Wednesday, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.